Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NSNI, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining Simon and I today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, are you in line for a tax cut? Pensioners, students, workers, savers, landlords, benefit claimants, the list goes on. But who are the winners and who are the losers as we welcome in, or not, the start of the new tax year? Either way, good or bad, Rachel is here to bring some sobering maths to our household finances. Simon cheers us up by toasting the success of British wine and giving us tips on investing in the stuff. We discover where in the UK is the most idyllic place to live and what driving manoeuvre brings us out in a cold sweat. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
It's the start of the new tax year, and with it comes a swathe of changes that will affect the pound in your pocket. But will you be better off or worse off? We've already had a rise in council tax and water bills that came in at the start of the month. The minimum wage increased too over the Easter bank holiday. But the change to your payslip doesn't end there. So let's have a quick rundown, starting with your wages. A very warm welcome to you both. Let's go first, shall we, to income tax thresholds.
Income tax thresholds have gone up for most people. So the amount of money that you can earn without paying any tax whatsoever, of course still national insurance, but no income tax whatsoever, has gone up from £11,500 to £11,850. So that you will see this month in your pay packet. The 40% threshold has also gone up. So when you start to earn 45 grand or above, the tax that you're charged is 40% instead of that 20%. The point at which that kicks in has gone up from £45,000 to £46,350. Again, if you are lucky enough to earn more than 45 grand, that will be more money in your pay packet there as well. If you earn more than £150,000, no change.
That's in England and Wales, though, right?
That's England and Wales, absolutely. Scotland has diverged. New, slightly different bands. The starter rate is the same, the £11,850, but it goes up to £13,850 for 19p, 20p up to £24,000, and then higher rate kicks in, that's 41p at £44,274 to £150. So it's 1p more, essentially, for people in that bracket.
And also, as I mentioned, the minimum wage going up, the living wage going up as well. But when the government giveth, the government taketh away, because I also mentioned that council tax has gone up an average of 5.3%. We've got quite a few to run down on. So, Simon, I'm going to come to you next and go to inheritance tax.
Oh, well, inheritance tax. This is the slightly odd pass on your own home to your direct descendants allowance that is being phased in so that eventually married couples or civil partners will be able to pass on £1 million. So you've got the inheritance tax allowance stays the same at £325,000 per person, £650,000 for spouses and civil partners if their deceased spouse or civil partner has passed their allowance on unused to them. Everything above that is taxed at 40%. But the main residence allowance, cooked up by a certain Mr. G. Osborne in his desire to increasingly complicate the tax system, rises to £125,000 from £100,000. So you've got one of those each. You've got £250,000 as a couple, plus £650,000. So you're on to £900,000 so far, and soon you will be on to £1 million. All of the rest of the stuff basically stays the same. But there is a sneaky trick in this main residence allowance, because it's not complicated enough already, in that once your estate goes above £2 million, as a couple it goes above £2 million, it starts to be withdrawn until eventually it dwindles down to nothing at all and you go back to the original inheritance tax-free allowance. And a direct descendant is either your children or your grandchildren. So it's also slightly unfair on people who don't have children or grandchildren. It's probably one of the dumbest bits in the tax code, apart from the uniquely dumb bit in the tax code where your personal allowance is taken off people at a rate of £1 for every £2 that you earn above £100,000. Rich folks' problems, but does mean that between £100,000 and £23,000 something, you pay a 60% rate of tax, which is the highest rate of tax that anybody pays in the country. And I literally cannot believe that that still exists in our tax code. It's
okay,
bonkers.
So those people still the losers, though descendants, direct descendants will be, I suppose, winners. We've got the losers who pay the council tax, the winners who receive the money, which is, well, all of us. Anyone who works, winners as well. Just one point about inheritance tax. Not many people pay it currently, but I guess the idea is because of high house prices, more people are being drawn into it.
So high house prices and the baby boomer generation who own a lot of that property dying off is going to see a lot more people pay inheritance tax. This own home allowance will take a lot of people out of it. However, I must say that I would imagine that if in a couple of years' time we do get a Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell-led government, then inheritance tax is definitely going to go up for people.
Yeah, there's lots of things I was looking at with that thought right in
well,
my
you might
mind.
Well, you might find that the income tax system changes to look more like the Scottish system that we were just talking about. And this is why this is interesting not only for people in Scotland, because what you might find is we start to get extra rates of tax being introduced into the system. So Scotland's now got a 19% rate, a 20% rate, a 21% rate, a 41% rate, and a 46% rate. So you might start to see more of those rates being pulled in as well.
All right then, pensions, Rachel.
Long-term winners, short-term might hurt. There's two things. One is the lifetime allowance is going up, currently 1 million, and another 30,000 will be added onto that. For those of us who aren't quite there yet, the thing that's probably more pertinent is the auto-enrolment contribution rates going up. Put in gently, 1% of people's incomes were diverted to pension savings, and that was matched by their employer. It's going up this year and now, actually, this month, to 3%, and then next year, 5%. That is a huge difference.
Yeah.
And people, I don't know necessarily, are aware that that will happen, but they will be soon because it will come out of their pay packets. Kind of increases that we will have seen due to the tax brackets moving up will be more than likely outweighed by the auto-enrolment increases.
How much of a concern is it? And we should point out as well that the employer will pay more, but not as much as you. I think it goes up to 2% and then 3% in the following year. How much of a concern is it that people will decide, actually, there's no way I can afford this? Because I think the BBC did some number crunching, which showed, and obviously there's a few caveats to this, as to what age you start putting money in, you could be £17,000 a year better off if you just stick to it.
This is the big question, and we're all just waiting on tenterhooks to see what will happen, because 1% wasn't enough really to counteract the inertia that we tend to have about these sorts of decisions, whereas 3%, people may start to feel that. And so the question is, will people decide to come out of the auto-enrolment scheme altogether, or whether they'll just suck it up, knowing that long-term they will be much better off staying in that system? What you are not allowed to do is put in a little bit. You have to go by these minimums. So if you were happy with 1%, not so happy now with 3%, tough luck. Mm. You have to stick with the 3%. And then next year, you'll have to stick with the 5%. So remains to be seen whether, one, people start pulling out altogether, and two, what kind of an impact that has on people's spending in general.
Should also point out with pensions as well, state pension is going up 3% because of that triple lock mechanism. We won't go into that and how long that will last. But I do want to ask you, Simon, about the lifetime allowance. Again, you mentioned earlier rich people's problems and all that. Who on earth is going to get over £1 million or £1,030,000? They're talking here. They keep tinkering with this too.
Well, we talked about this last week, actually, on the show when we were talking about pensions and about using the pension calculator and the fact that actually there are loads of people in their 30s and 40s who are going to hit the lifetime allowance. And I don't think they imagine that they will ever hit the lifetime allowance. But if you've got a decent job, a decent pension scheme and you've been paying into it since you were in your late 20s and the stock market does all right, you're probably going to hit that £1 million. Once you get beyond that level, there is pretty much no point stuffing anything into a pension. And also, you've then got this difficult question of what happens when you get close to it? So if you get 20% away from the lifetime allowance, because it's not what you pay in, it's what you pay in plus the growth in there. Once you get to 20% below it, should you just stop paying money in? It's quite a difficult one to work out. And just to say that it has gone up. However, it had only recently fallen all the way down to a million. And so this is a SOP, but this isn't even a particularly good SOP, because £30,000 on the lifetime allowance is the equivalent to your pension fund managing to grow by a princely 3%. If your pension went up by 3% in a year, you'd think that was a pretty bad year. Mm. And funnily enough, inflation is also nearly 3%. So basically, your pension fund goes up by just a tiny bit more than what the current inflation figure is. You've already eaten up the entire benefit of the £30,000 rise in the lifetime allowance. And we talked about dumb bits of the tax code earlier. This is another bit that is identified by pretty much everyone as being a really stupid bit of the tax code. And yet successive governments continue to do nothing about it.
All right, savers, Rachel, talking about things going up. No change to the ISA limit except for junior ISAs, but not a lot of good cheer for savers.
No, not really. I think that the logic, I mean, Lee actually asked them last week, is the what will be the ISA limit next year? And I think that they're just so happy with themselves for having got us up to 20 grand that they intend to rest on their laurels, certainly next year. And I reckon for a little while longer. That just seems to be how things play out. Some things are uprated by inflation, others aren't. And it seems pretty arbitrary to me which ones are chosen. The benefits cap, for example, is in the third year of a four-year pay freeze. So 10 million households see no increase to child tax credit, child benefit, job seekers allowance and universal credit.
Which the Institute for Fiscal Studies say will be the hardest freeze, I believe, that's come yet. And on average, a family with two children will be about £300 worth off a year.
Yeah, £315 less than they would have had the freeze not been in place. Mm. So it's not like the decision whether or not to increase by inflation is determined by need or anything like that in particular. It does just seem to be a little bit arbitrary to me.
All of this seems a bit robbing Peter to pay Paul economics. You know, give a little, take a little. Is anyone actually better off?
Well, we don't have any money, do we? So there's a slight problem. But, I mean, you know, this is in terms of income-wise... This is a bit of a giveaway for people. Obviously, there's the stuff on the other end of it that is going to hit people. Council tax rises.
Water bills,
things like
freezing.
That. But it's better to get a tax cut at the same time as your council tax is going up and all your other bills are going up than it is for all your bills to go up and to not get a tax cut.
That is true, Simon.
Now, what has been led to some questioning of what's going on here is that the biggest chunk of benefit from the tax cut is going to go to people falling in between about the sort of £45,000 and £100,000 a year bracket. So they're going to get about £236 each as an individual. Whereas those earning £20,000 to about that £45,000 level are going to get £101 each as a tax cut. Once you then go up to the higher earners, they're going to get £96. So there's the suggestion of, hang on a minute, why are we giving money to the people with more money? But what lies behind that is this shift in the 40% income tax band. And the reason why that's happening is because it's trying to redress some of the fiscal drag that we've seen over the years.
What does fiscal drag mean?
What you do is by keeping a tax threshold level whilst the thing that you are taxing is going up, i.e. people's wages are rising, you know, year in, year out, by a little bit, or inflation's going up or things like that, you drag more people into it. So as an example, by not raising the stamp duty thresholds, as house prices go up, you drag many, many more people into paying higher rates of stamp duty. By not raising the 40% income tax bracket, as people's wages have gone up, you drag many, many people into that bracket. And so this is trying to do something to reverse a bit of that. And there is a pledge to get it up to £50,000, which actually would still mean that there's way more people paying it than once did. I suppose on the flip side, you know, our top rates of tax are now lower than they were if you go back sort of 20, 30 years kind of thing. But there are some interesting figures, which is that the top 10% of earners, so that is basically people who earn above £54,000 a year, pay more than half of the UK's income tax, which is a lot, isn't
it?
Yeah. And then the highest earning 1%, those are people who earn more than £165,000, pay 27% of it. It's not to say that they should or shouldn't be paying that, but it's very interesting that when you get the kind of rhetoric that we must make the wealthy and we must make the high earners pay their fair share of tax, actually, if you do drill down into the figures, it does appear that high earners do definitely pay their fair share of tax.
Just a quick one on that, though. Does it sound like there's not so much the squeezed middle? We keep hearing that, don't we? And yet, again, I think I was reading Paul Johnson from the IFS, that actually it is those at the top and those at the bottom who are them being the most impacted at the moment. Is that fair? Do you agree with that argument?
I think that that is true because those at the bottom have had the most taken away from them because they tend to rely on the state for more. And those at the top, they've had a higher rate of tax imposed on them. We've already talked about how some of them are paying a 60% rate of tax, but, you know, further up the scale, they're paying 45%. They've had big removals on the amount of money that they can pay into a pension and things like that. People earning more than £60,000 a year have had all their child benefit taken off them. There is a lot of stuff that has been taken off what would be considered higher earners. And I guess, say, let's break it down to the top 10%, the above 54,000 people. They have had quite a lot taken away from them. And if you look at the top 1%, they have as well. I think the real concern, though, for people is that once you go above the level where people are earning a kind of what we would define as a PAYE, pay-as-you-earn salary kind of thing, once you move into the realm of people earning more than £500,000 a year or earning millions of pounds a year, then you start to question whether those people are paying their fair share of tax, because that's where you start to get a lot of the shuffling around. And it's tax avoidance, it's not tax evasion.
They can afford the good accountants,
they're only playing
right
within the laws, but they can afford the good accountants. Now, you could argue that someone who is earning £2 million a year and is paying £500,000 in tax probably thinks that they're paying their fair share, but they are paying a lower percentage tax rate than someone potentially who is earning considerably less than that. I think what will be interesting is if we start to see the imposition of an extra tax and perhaps a hypothecated tax to do something like pay for the NHS. Governments don't like ring fencing taxes. There are some good reasons for that, which is that if the economy turns down and everyone's incomes fall, all of a sudden you don't have enough money. But there are some bad reasons for that, and that's because they like to basically have control over all the money and not have it put towards one thing. I think if we do need the extra money to pay for the NHS, then a hypothecated tax to do that is not a bad idea, because if you said to people, will you pay an extra 2-3% of your earnings and we promise that we will use this money to sort the NHS,
yep,
then I think a lot of people would back it, and I probably would.
I would, absolutely. Rachel, your views about all of this?
There's huge public appetite for that. I think one of the things that we would do ourselves a big favour by getting right is by talking more about where our taxes go. I think that there's a real sense that it all goes into the pot and it goes on waste and bureaucracy and things that people don't really believe in. So ring fencing does seem to be one way of getting that message across. Most people are very happy to pay taxes towards things like the NHS. And if you actively correlate those two things, you put in this and this is the outcome, people might be more happy to spend those taxes.
I agree. And what we want is it to be fair. And talking about NHS and talking about tax changes this April, one thing that really gets my goat, I'm sorry to say it, but is prescription charges. They're going up in England alone from £8.60 to £8.80. Of course, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland all abolish such charges for that. In terms of other increases or changes, fuel duty, that's frozen for another year. We've spoken about the vehicle excise duty for new diesel cars. The increase can be up to £310 a year. Listen to podcast pass on that one. Tobacco tax, well, that's going up again. Air passenger duty frozen for short haul flights, going up a little bit for a longer haul flight. We also have a few other changes to talk about very briefly. Simon, buy-to-let landlords?
Yes, this is a change that's being ushered in for buy-to-let, and it is definitely hurting landlords. Previously, It was dead simple. What you did is you took your mortgage interest costs and you could offset them against your income tax bill on rental income, and you could offset all of it, which meant that if you were a 20% taxpayer, you got the 20% offset. And if you were a 40% taxpayer, you got the 40% offset. The rules that are coming in mean that it's going to change to being a maximum 20% tax credit on your mortgage interest. And there's a difference in the calculation as well. You now have to add your rental income to your own income. You then work backwards from that. Whereas previously, you just basically took the mortgage off the rental income and just paid tax on the difference. So you were just paying tax on your profits. Now you are paying tax on some of your revenue. Landlords could claim 3/4 of their mortgage interest at the higher rate of tax and 1/4 at the lower basic rate tax. From the start of the new tax year, you can only claim higher rate tax relief on half your costs and the other half at basic rate. And then that's going to be whittled down until 2021, when higher rate relief disappears completely and you can only claim basic rate tax relief. What this basically does is dents the figures for some buy-to-let landlords, many of whom have got mortgages and are going to find that they're now paying tax on money that they don't see that's going on mortgage interest.
Students, Rachel.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but it's good news.
What?
No, seriously, it is. The amount of money that you
it's
have to be...
relative, though, isn't it, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is a tiny bit less worse. The point at which you have to start paying your student loan back is going up. And, of course, it's not straightforward. It all depends on when you took your loan out and blah-de-blah and where you are. But roughly, it'll be a few quid a month that some students won't have to pay yet.
Moving on, because we've talked about the winners and the losers, but apparently, according to Rachel, and the help of some rather useful, if a touch gloomy, graphs, we are all going to be losers in the coming months if the UK economy doesn't do too well. Because obviously pickups, downturns, they're all inevitable. These things happen. But the Bank of England and the ONS reckon if it does, and if we all get bad news, well, many households could really struggle. And Rachel, there are four main factors or graphs that you have on your website with which to prove this, or which have been looking into this, and that is the household savings ratio hitting a record low, household borrowing nearing record highs, wages falling and prices continuing to rise. Now, what I want to know is, when we say bad news and when we say struggle, what do we mean?
It's a really good question. I think lots of people are already. But what I noticed in these graphs, it was just two reports that came out, one from the Bank of England, one from the Office for National Statistics, and they painted a picture of real... Is this precariousness a word?
Works for me, yeah.
Yeah, you like it? Anyway, it looked really worrying, and presented a picture of millions of people with really no buffer. If things sort of tick along as they are, maybe that will be fine. But there is not much protecting millions of households, is what these graphs present. And they really kind of all work together. So at the top, you've got earnings just not going up. And what you might expect would happen when people's earnings don't go up, or fall in real terms, then they might spend less. But actually, these figures show people are spending just as much. It's just that it's coming out of debt. £207 billion of unsecured debt. That doesn't include people's mortgages or student loans. That's just like credit cards. A lot of it is car finance, personal loans. £207 billion. So it's coming out of debt, and it's also coming out of people's savings. The savings ratio, so the amount of money that we stash away from our incomes every month, has gone down to 4.9%. It's about £4.90 out of every 100 quid we get. It's never been lower. So we have a smaller amount of savings to fall back on, high levels of debt. And I think one of the things when we see these high debt figures, and it's very easy to say, oh, well, people should spend less. And perhaps, you know, we all stopped spending so much money on fizzy drinks, then we might be better off. But Step Change says that 1.4 million households are using high-cost credit for basic living expenses. And then the fourth stinker on top of all of that is the price of stuff going up, which it has been and continues to do so, around still hovering around 3%, which is much higher than really we'd like it to be. So there's no let-up there either. So you put that all together, and I'm worried.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. making saving that little bit more exciting.
Goodness me, all that gloom and doom. Well, let's lighten things up, shall we, with a glass of wine, perhaps? British naturally, because it has been a bumper time for UK winemakers as homegrown is soaring in popularity. A record 3.8 million bottles were produced last year. That's up two-thirds on the year before. All very positive news, but apparently, shock thought here, you don't actually have to drink the stuff. Simon, you've been chatting with some experts and getting some tips for anyone interested in investing in wine. And Simon, we're not necessarily talking here about British wine, but why on earth would you want to invest in it? So Alec Ferguson was a big fan, wasn't he?
He was, yes. Well, look, wine investment, it's attractive for two reasons. One, it's considered what's known as an alternative asset. So it's something that you can hold that's different to your other investments and might not move in the same direction as them. So, for example, if the stock market turns down, your wine might still hold some of its value. Secondly, I think because people like wine and they're interested in wine and there's a whole following around it. And it is one of those things that really is priced very much on sentiment. Wine, classic cars, gold even, which has a long-term record as a store of value. But they don't produce anything. It's not like investing in a company. If you're investing in wine, you're investing in its scarcity, its rarity, and the fact that it is prized for the vintage, the quality, or just the fact that people think it's going to go up in value. However, it's a very interesting world. And £400 a sip, 12 bottles of 1988 Romani Conti wine, sold for £179,250, equated to £400 a sip if you were going to drink it. Highly unlikely anyone's going to drink it, though. That was back in February, but there is another 12 bottles up for sale on Thursday with £160,000 to £180,000 guide price at Bonham's next fine wine auction to be held at New Bond Street. Now, it's highly unlikely that that kind of figure is going to make you think that it's possible to invest in wine. However, there are increasing numbers of people using wine merchants' seller plans to invest. And with these, you can invest from as little as £50 or £100 a month. And the wine merchants have wised up to the fact that they need to start trying to attract a new, younger clientele. And they're as happy to help someone who's got £1,000 to invest as they are people who've got thousands of pounds to invest. A couple of things you need to think about, though. Firstly, there's a lot of sharks out there. So you need to deal with people with good reputations and you need to really investigate those reputations properly, because any alternative investment tends to attract the sort of get-rich-quick merchants. So if you're starting out and you don't know much about it, then you want to invest alongside someone who's got a really good reputation. Fortunately, there are a number of companies that have been around for many years who have that kind of reputation, and there are companies that have been around for less time but also have good reputations. So, for example, I spoke to Simon Staples of Berry Brothers and Rudd. That company was established in 1698. You've got Corney and Barrow, which started in 1780. And more recent businesses with good reputations, you've got Lee and Sanderman and Farr Vintners. They measure their lifespan in decades. But these people, if you speak to them and say, I'd like to start investing in wine, they'll ask you about what you're interested in, what you might like to invest in, how much money you've got, and they'll walk alongside you and help you do it. Now, what you need to do, unfortunately, is probably never take delivery of that wine. So you can't stick it in the garage and go out and admire your wine collection. And you probably shouldn't even have a wine cellar built at home. And this is for tax reasons. So you want to keep it in...
That was not what I was thinking of for tax reasons.
You want to make sure that it's stored under bond, or in bond as it's known. And this avoids paying excise duty and VAT on the wine. It also helps you not have to pay capital gains tax on it. Also helps with the provenance. So what's really important to someone investing in wine is that the bottles of wine that they are buying are what they are meant to be, and that they can, not only can they get the provenance of the wine proved to them from you, but they can prove it to the next person that they might sell it on to. People prefer cases of wine that haven't been broken, so most fine wines will leave the vineyard in cases of 6, 3, 12, perhaps even 1 just in a box, but you want that original wooden case to be there, ideally unopened. And then also, if it's been stored properly by a well-respected wine merchant in bond, then they will know that that wine has been looked after. Because the other problem is, of course, is that it needs to be maintained at a regular temperature to keep the wine's condition. So even if, for example, you store your wine in your garage, the temperature in that garage could swing from just above freezing in wintertime to 20-something degrees in summertime. So that's not going to do you any favours at all. But if you do want to invest, what do we need to think about? Well, firstly, it is based on sentiment. So since 2003, the Livex Fine Wine 100 Index, which measures the world's most sought-after wines, has trebled in value. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. However, it's also still 15% below its peak achieved in 2011. So it just shows how things swing around. Secondly, don't pile all your money into it. This is the kind of thing that if you put a small amount of your assets into it, then you're following what is perceived to be best investing wisdom. If you put all your money into it, or the bulk of your money into it, then all of a sudden you have skewed yourself massively towards the wine world and you are out of kilter with what is decided to be the best way to invest. Now, you might decide that that makes it a hobby. Is that then an investment? You can compare this to kind of the classic car thing. You know, if you spend £50,000 on a classic car, is that an investment, really?
I get the idea about a hobby, but haven't you always said in the past, if you're going to do this sort of alternative investing, it's well worth doing something you actually care about, you actually know something about?
Exactly. And this is the point that was made by Simon Staples, who I spoke to of Berry Brothers, who said, if you're interested in wine, then it's great. It opens up a whole world. You know, if you do one of these cellar plans, you're going to get invitations to wine tastings and events. You're going to learn loads about fine wine. You're going to learn what makes a good wine. You're going to taste wines from all around the world. You're going to sample some that you might never, ever get to try. Certainly something that I think, oh, yeah, it's quite interesting. I'm really interested in this. I don't know whether I'd invest a large amount of money in it. I never have done. But there is a question, at what point does it stop being an investment and start being a hobby?
One final point. Does wine ever go off?
It depends what wine it is. So if you were to buy a bottle of cheap wine, then it wouldn't keep. It would taste rubbish. You can find that even if you buy fine wine, then it's not great when you open it.
Don't say like 1 in 20 or 1 in 25 is corked as well.
Yeah, you know, there is that issue that goes with it. But that's why you spread your risk by buying different wines. And the wine investment world is still very much dominated by Bordeaux, because that has always been the most sought after of the wines, because it's the old chateaus. They've got the great reputation for the great wines. But Burgundy is the wine that's gone up by the most recently, and also there are now more investable wines than there have been, according to Livex, who run this index that measures the price of wine. They said the world of investable wine is spreading constantly.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
No, yeah,
very
absolutely.
Interesting thing to find out about.
While we're at it, let's raise a glass, shall we? Not £400 a sip, but let's raise a glass to the Orkney Islands in Scotland. It has just been named as the most idyllic rural district in the UK. But what is it about the Orkney Islands? And why does Raven and Richmondshire in Yorkshire and Humber have the happiest adults? Rachel, what's all this about?
It is an annual study by Halifax. They consider a bunch of different factors that they think are key to quality of life, and they score each of them out of 10 and then sort of put them all in a pot, stir it up and find out who's got the highest ratings. And the Orkney Islands come out top again. So the types of things that they consider are health, life expectancy, things like that, education, primary school class sizes, GCSE results, and then personal well-being, levels of life satisfaction, worthwhileness, happiness.
Worthwhileness? How do you measure that?
Well, actually,
tick a box and go, do you feel worthwhile?
I think largely, yes. These are
okay.
The ones around well-being are, I think, from the ONS, which started to ask this some time ago, as well as looking into things like what we're paid and whatever, life expectancy. They also ask questions about happiness. So the worthwhile one is, I think the question is something along the lines of, do you believe what you do in life is worthwhile? Do you want to guess what the average is?
Go for it.
7.9 out of 10.
7.9?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite high.
Yeah. Leisure. They look at the number of pubs in an area.
What are house prices looking like in those sorts of areas? Do people read these sorts of surveys and go, ooh, my life is going to be so much more worthwhile if I go and move there?
Well, they look at house prices, I think, in relation to wages, how affordable houses are, which does end up with all sorts of funny quirks, I think, depending on what the industries are in particular areas.
Good on you if you lived there. And finally, to a story this week that was the cause of many a knowing smile, no doubt, and actually probably some rather shocked faces as well. We got a list of the most hated driving manoeuvres, and it was, of course, the dreaded parallel park, some drivers even admitting driving many extra miles to avoid it. Now, most of these are parking related, I was interested to see. Nothing to do with Islington Council, by the way. But also on the list was navigating a roundabout, which I swear I'm never getting on the road again if that comes in the top 10. Simon, tell us more.
Yes, I chuckled when I saw that. So there was a survey done by Accident Advice Helpline, and they asked 2,000 people for their top 10 trickiest driving manoeuvres. Now, of all these people, apparently, who didn't like these things, 47% of drivers have at some point attempted a parallel park that went so disastrously wrong they simply gave up and drove on rather than giving it a second go. 15% claim parallel parking leaves them feeling anxious, and 1 in 10 believe a difficult manoeuvre makes them feel stressed or nervous. I was actually a bit surprised at that 47% figure. I think that there's a far greater percentage of people who've stuffed up parallel parking and gone, do you know what, I'm just not getting in this space, and gone and parked somewhere else.
46 are probably the ones that smashed the cars at the back and the front and had to leave so that no one could tell it was them.
Ah, the Milanese kiss.
Exactly.
That's what it's called in Milan, yes. When you bounce backwards and forwards between cars to get your car parked. Yes. My friend lives in Milan. So these top 10 tricky driving manoeuvres for Britons. I'm going to do a reverse countdown in Top of the Pop style. Mm-hmm. In at number 10, we've got pulling up on the right-hand side of the road. So basically, you drive on the left,
yep,
and you
Thank
spot
you,
somewhere. Does that
it's
count
been,
as mansplaining?
It's been a while. Actually, yeah. To be fair, it's been a while since I've been driving. I did read that and go, how hard is that?
You just looked at me quizzically. Look, you have to pull up on the opposite side of the road, okay? The emergency stop at number 9. Mm-hmm. At number 8, we've got a surprise entry from navigating a roundabout.
Oh, just...
Now, what I think this reflects is not necessarily that people are so bad at driving that they struggle with navigating a roundabout. What I think it reflects is that people are responding with the things that make them stressed, and people get to a roundabout and for some reason they feel stressed because maybe there's lots of lanes or lots of cars coming. So the difficulty of getting out onto the roundabout kind of thing. You do actually get some mini roundabouts that basically remove people's brains from their heads, and everybody sits there in this kind of weird standoff because they can't work out who's meant to go first. Number 7, parking close to the curb. 6, reversing in a straight line. People who weave down the road reversing, try not to hit another car doing it. Number 5, driving forward into a parking bay. You're in the supermarket, you need to park. Driving forward into the parking bay, you find that tricky.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's number 4.
That's number 5, actually.
5.
Number 4 is a turn in the road / 3-point turn. Beloved of learner
those.
Drivers everywhere.
Yeah.
I loved 3-point
yeah,
turns.
Those.
Do you know what? I prided myself on my 3-point turn when I did my driving test. Of course, the great thing about once you've done your driving test is you A, either no longer need to do 3-point turns, or B, you could basically just do them wrong and
there
not
are
pay
so
much
many.
Attention.
Exactly, yes, about 18-point turn.
Yeah.
There are so many of those on the list that I think I haven't done since
yeah.
I passed my test.
Exactly, and coming on to that, we've got the top 3. At 3, we have reversing round a corner. At 2, we have the opposite of parking forward in a parking bay. We have reverse into a parking bay. So people find reversing into parking bays much trickier than driving forwards into them. Of course, if you reverse into a parking bay, it is then easier to get out of. Mm. Although I must admit, I am a driving into a parking
Me
bay
too.
Forwards person rather than reversing into one. And then at number 1, we have the perennial favourite or non-favourite, and that is parallel parking.
Yeah. On my driving test, I combined a couple of those, the emergency stop and parallel park, and possibly even the driving to the other side of the road as well. I still passed.
Well done to you. I must say,
thank you very much.
Parallel parking has got easier due to the widespread use of power steering and also parking aids that ding, 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 and then louder when you get nearer to a car. I have an old car. It's a small car. It's a Peugeot 205 GTI, but it does not have power steering. And because it's got big tyres on it, it is a brute to parallel park. It really is.
Rachel,
I hate all of them.
Excellent. That's
just
the
thinking
spirit.
About it makes me nervous.
Thank you very much. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.